Serious question as we get going today. How much should government tell business what they can think? It's not so easy, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, the 28th of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. There are a whole lot of threads to pull out in the national conversation we're having right now about gun violence. Political threads, to be sure. President Trump did one of those televised meetings with congressional leaders at the White House today. It's unclear how that one's going to play out. There are economic threads as well. The decision today by Dick's Sporting Goods to stop selling assault-style rifles in its stores is one of those. And then there are the threads that get, well, tangled, I guess you'd say, that cross both political and economic lines. Delta Airlines in the state of Georgia is one of those. A push by the lieutenant governor there and some others to cut a tax break for Delta after the airline cut its ties with the National Rifle Association. Eric Erickson is an Atlanta-based conservative political commentator. He is also the editor-in-chief of The Resurgent. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Let's do a little establishment of facts here, first of all. Delta is not losing a tax break so much as not getting one back, right?
Correct. They lost it in 2015 when the state restructured how it raises transportation taxes.
And now the governor, the lieutenant governor, rather, and some other members of the government in the state of Georgia have said, we're not interested in what you're doing on the NRA, and we're not going to pass this thing.
Correct. The lieutenant governor, interestingly enough, was one of the biggest proponents of restoring the tax exemption until this weekend when Delta distanced itself from the NRA.
And we should say here, Delta is no stranger to the lobbying halls of the Georgia legislature. They know them pretty well in Atlanta.
Correct. Delta actually has a very successful lobbying relationship with the state legislature. Conservatives tend not to care for them because they frequently lobby against social conservative legislation in the Georgia legislature. But they've got great relationships. And in fact, the legislature wanted to give Delta this tax exemption because they are under a strong belief that Delta would then expand the number of international destinations from Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport.
Okay, so let's get to the substance then of your thoughts on this. You're kind of happy that this exemption went away, but not for the reasons that are getting all the play.
I don't think that Delta should have this tax exemption. In fairness, Atlanta is the only major aviation hub in the country that doesn't give a sales tax exemption on aviation fuel. But it is part of, I think, crony capitalism, where the government picks winners and losers as opposed to just having a level business playing field. So I was opposed to Delta getting the tax exemption, but I am equally opposed to any government punishing a business because of who the business does or does not do business with it. I am someone who supports the NRA myself, but I couldn't care less whether Delta wants to support them or not. It's their business.
So how does this get reconciled then in the state of Georgia and elsewhere? Because certainly Delta is not the only company, and Georgia is probably not the only state that will have a look at this, where you have opponents of crony capitalism, corporate welfare, at the same time punishing privately held companies for their views.
I think conservatives in particular are going to have to say that this is unacceptable for the government to be picking winners and losers, as they did in the Obama administration. They should continue to do this during the Trump administration. I don't know that there's a good solution because so many businesses, Delta included, are notorious for supporting these systems of the government picking the winners and losers because these major corporations tend to be the winners.
Well, let's talk about another major corporation that has its eyes on Atlanta, just since I have you on the phone. Amazon is thinking about has put Atlanta on the top 20 list for its HQ2, its second headquarters. Do you think other companies are looking at Georgia going, wait a minute?
Yeah, they may be. My sense is that Atlanta probably isn't going to hurt itself because of this act in the state legislature, largely because the way Georgia structures economic deals bypasses the legislature to begin with. So they wouldn't have to worry about dealing with the politicians the way Delta does for the tax exemption.
Do you anticipate that there will be honest brokerage in any of this debate between companies and governments?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, take Georgia, for example, dealing with Amazon. Georgia is one of the few states that won't disclose to taxpayers what exactly it offers to major corporations to lure them to their states. When there's a lack of transparency, they can get away with much.
Eric Erickson is the editor-in-chief at theresurgent.com. Eric, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
On Wall Street today, interestingly enough, shares of both Dick's Sporting Goods and Delta Airlines up about 0.6%. Also, and not for nothing, but Fed Chair Jay Powell spent the last 2 days telling Congress what he thinks of the economy. Traders clearly don't think too much of his message. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Okay, changing gears here for a bit. Everybody has their favorite pizza, right? Either a big chain or a place maybe down the block. Turns out the NFL has a go-to as well. Pizza Hut is now the official sponsor of the National Football League, replacing Papa John's, which announced yesterday it is ending its deal with the NFL. And lest you think this is pure product placement on the league's part, and while the league's audience numbers have been down over the past couple of years, and yes, a couple of months ago, the founder and CEO of Papa John's got himself in some hot water, if you remember, over players kneeling in protest during the national anthem. There still ain't, as Marketplace's Andy Euler reports, nothing that succeeds in business like success.
You've seen Mad Men. When a company loses a major advertising sponsor, there's normally a scramble to figure out how they're going to make up for that lost revenue. Not so with the NFL.
It took them 14 hours to replace their pizza sponsor.
Bob Dorfman works in sports marketing at Baker Street Advertising. He says there have been a lot of stories about the NFL's ratings taking a hit in recent years for a number of reasons. National anthem protests, players with domestic abuse records, and people just cutting the cord on watching TV. But there were multiple national pizza companies that wanted a partnership with the NFL.
It's still one of the most important brands in entertainment. For reaching the 18 to 49-year-olds, there's nothing better out there than the NFL.
Pizza Hut's trying to catch up to competitors like Domino's in the mobile space. The NFL spends a lot of money there already, so Pizza Hut thinks this partnership will help. Neither party released details about the money involved in the deal, but we do know the contract runs through 2021. The recently terminated Papa John's deal was supposed to run through 2020. John Arand is media reporter at the Sports Business Journal.
The NFL ended up getting more money and more years out of this new deal than they had with Papa John's.
But he says Papa John's isn't left completely out of the American pro football landscape.
Papa John's has 22 teams that it actually has local deals with.
22 of 32 teams. So Papa John's can't blast out a national message during a football game, but if it wants to sell pizza to a Dallas Cowboys fan, there's nothing to stop the team's star players from appearing in a local Papa John's commercial to help make that happen. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Amazon has done something it usually depends on us, the humble consumer, to do. It has bought something, Ring by name. It's a company that makes smart doorbells with security cameras inside for what is said to be just north of $1 billion. The deal could help Amazon solve its door theft problems, packages left on doorsteps and getting stolen. But really, the upsell here might be in the extra juice that Ring gives Amazon in the fight over control of the connected home. Marketplace's Rima Crace explains that one.
Back in 2013, a young entrepreneur went on the reality show Shark Tank and pitched his smart doorbell with a camera inside. He was looking for $700K for 10% of the company.
I just don't see the progression, and for that reason, I'm out.
Yeah, that was Mark Cuban echoing all of the sharks.
I'm sure, you know, Mark Cuban and them will do just fine.
Blake Kozak is an analyst with IHS Market. He says it makes more sense for Amazon to buy Ring than to spend years developing the technology itself. The companies already have a partnership.
The smart home market is growing, you know, at a clip of, you know, 30 to 50% every year.
And Kozak says Amazon has about a 10% share of that market, which includes everything from internet-connected thermostats to smart speakers like the Echo. He says Ring could help Amazon better compete with Google, which has the edge now with its Nest thermostat and security system. Forrester analyst James McQuivey says Amazon is also likely to add more intelligent features to Ring's gadgets. He says Amazon's devices are already
answering your questions about the weather, telling you a joke, playing you music, and now telling you whether or not your fifth grader made it home on time.
Aaron Kessler is an analyst at Raymond James. He expects Amazon will target the Ring doorbell, which costs $179, to
someone who's more tech savvy is obviously going to be your early adopter. Someone who's in an urban market who's more concerned about security of their home.
He says for many other people, the devices will be nice to haves, not so much need to haves. I'm Rima Crace from Marketplace.
While special counsel Robert Mueller beavers away on his investigation into Russian influence on this country's politics, there are new signs to report of potential Russian influence on the American food supply. Specifically, what appears to be a coordinated information campaign to discredit genetically modified crops, GMOs, as they're often called. Now, Why would the Russians want to run down GMO crops, which already do suffer in the reputation department? Marketplace's Scott Tong is on that one from Washington.
GMOs are divisive, and U.S. coverage is split pro and con. But in 2016, Russian state websites RT and Sputnik swamped the U.S. internet with entirely anti-GMO coverage. This according to new analysis from Iowa State researchers. Co-author Carolyn Lawrence Dill found GMOs are bad articles, and she found clickbait to lure people already in a bad online mood.
You could find something that's on the topic of abortion or TPP, and then you would get all the way to the bottom of the article, and there would be some link to, are you interested in related information on GMOs?
It all suggests a coordinated campaign, says co-researcher Sean Dorius. So why would Moscow taint GMO food from America? He says it could steer global consumers to non-GMO crops from Russia.
Agriculture is a really important sector in the Russian economy. It's the number two industry in their economy. It's a growing area. It's an area that they're, you know, out marketing and trying to differentiate themselves.
In general, Russian disinformation campaigns try to sow discord, says NYU's Joshua Tucker. He studies Russia and social media. And he sees signs that Sputnik and RT headlines try to influence not just humans, but also search engines.
Search engine optimization would be a concerted strategy to try to make it when you go to search for GMOs, you actually see something from RT or you see something from Sputnik.
By the way, that paper on GMOs and disinformation, it's called Sowing the Seeds of Skepticism. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up,
it relies on the environmental aspects or environmental qualities of the community rather than being the extractive industry.
From being an old coal town to being a hiking and biking town. Straight ahead. But first, sure, why not? Let's do the numbers. Oh, once again, I had the Wawa's figure the Dow off 380 points, 1.5%. What does a guy have to do? Closed at 25,029. The NASDAQ down 57 points, about 0.7%, 72.73. The S&P 500 slipped 30 points, 1.1%, 27.13. Jay Powell, we are not looking at you. Talked about the Russian information campaign that targeted U.S. agriculture around GMOs. Monsanto grew 0.5% today. Archer Daniels Midland plowed down 0.2%. Look at how Pizza Hut is topping off the day with that NFL deal we mentioned. Pizza Hut parent company Yum Brands heated up 1.4% on this Wednesday. Papa John's delivered 2.4%, so there. We mentioned Amazon is buying Ring for $1 billion American simoleons. Amazon stayed about the same. Home security company ADT, though, lost nearly 9%. Ouch. Google parent Alphabet dropped 1.2%. Bond prices? Well, thanks for asking. They rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.86%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You know, you don't like the way something's being done. Sometimes you just got to do it yourself, right? It's true in life. True also in business. Healthcare in the present example. Intermountain Healthcare, it runs hospitals and manages other medical services in Utah and parts of Idaho, has announced it's going to be partnering with a handful of other big health systems to start and run a drug company. It'll be nonprofit, trying to get cheaper generic medications into the supply pipeline. Mark Harrison is the CEO of Intermountain Healthcare. Welcome to the program.
Nice to be here, Kai. Thank you.
Why do you think you, as a hospital complex CEO, can crack this nut of availability and cost on these drugs?
That's a really good question. So I think that, you know, we're particularly Intermountain as a payer provider, we see both sides of the equation. It's one of those things, you know, if not us, who? I think the ability of this project to attract talent has been absolutely remarkable to me. And so I'm just a doctor and I run a system, but we have pharma executives coming out of the woodwork asking to work on this project. I think we are going to have a knock 'em dead, you know, A+ executive team.
Okay, when you sit down with those pharma executives, right, who have a skill set that is outside your core competency, what do they say about things like supply chain and manufacturer agreeability and those kinds of things?
They think it's entirely soluble. We, you know, as you might imagine, the team's put together a really thorough business plan, and we've been guided by a couple of very senior retired pharma execs who have played in this space, and I think we've gamed out most of those problems. Mm. And as you probably know, there's actually a lot of contract manufacturing capacity out mm-hmm. there. Mm-hmm. So we don't, you know, we're not planning on building factories. Nothing's off the table, but we think we're going to be able to use capacity that's available and supply chain that's, you know, been used forever. And again, these are not like miracle drugs.
Yeah, we should be clear here. We're talking generics.
We are talking generics.
Right.
We're talking mostly hospital-based drugs to start with, but also some outpatient drugs. And you know, I'm going to play it close to my vest in terms of what they are, because we don't want to signal, you know, too obviously what we're going to make.
I think it's very interesting you're playing close to your chest. So clearly there's an element of I need to maintain my business advantage here.
We do. Look, you know, this sector, and it's really a portion of the sector, there are a lot of good generic drug makers out there who play fair and square, and they try their best to serve their customers and patients. It's really the bad actors who are, you know, have driven a lot of competition out of the market, and they've driven price up as they've created artificial shortages. Those are the ones that we're going to really focus on. And, you know, it would be our dream if we never had to make a single tablet. But I don't think that's going to happen.
Acknowledging that not too long ago, Jeff Bezos at Amazon and Jamie Dimon at JPMorgan Chase and Warren Buffett at Berkshire Hathaway came in and said they're going to start some kind of healthcare enterprise. How worried are you about getting bigfooted out of this by, say, Jeff Bezos, who could, in theory, do whatever he wants?
You know what? We're not doing this for ego. We're doing this for patients. If he comes along with something better, if they come along with something better for patients, do away with the shortages, have prices be fair, then more power to him. That would be just fine. My guess is, and we're open to it, and there have actually been a couple of preliminary conversations, we very well may collaborate with those folks.
Hmm. That seems newsworthy that you've been having a little chit-chat with Jeff Bezos and the gang about this.
No, I have not personally. Well,
not you. I understand it's a team. Right?
Yeah, but there have been some quiet conversations, and who knows what will happen.
What then, as you think about this company you are starting for generic pharmaceuticals, and as you as the CEO have to grow Intermountain Health because that's fundamentally your job, what does this venture you're launching look like in, say, 5 years?
What I'm hoping in 5 years for this venture, I'm hoping that we're going to be serving thousands of hospitals. I hope we'll have more than half of the U.S. market getting generic drugs from us. More importantly, I think some of these artificial shortages will be gone, and people will be able to afford their medications without the pain that they currently are. I'll tell you a quick story. I was talking to one of our primary care docs recently, and he had taken care of a kid who had swimmer's ear. So it's an infection and inflammation of the ear canal. And you normally give the patient some topical antibiotics, and sometimes you'll give them a topical steroid to decrease the inflammation. The steroid that he prescribed a couple years ago had been $7 for a course. It was $75 now. And this was one of those generic drugs that had been gobbled up. And for patients who are paying a lot out of pocket, that's criminal.
When I was a kid, my mother used to drip rubbing alcohol in my ears after I went swimming. That's how we got out of swimmer's
ear. You must have been very bad, because I bet that hurt.
Yeah, it did hurt, but that's a whole different interview. All right, excellent. Mark Harrison, the CEO of Intermountain Healthcare. Mark, thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks, Kai. It's a pleasure.
True story about the rubbing alcohol. Mom's probably listening now, too, actually. You can hear the rest of my conversation with Mark Harrison on our Corner Office podcast. Get it wherever you like. Part of the national economic storyline in this country goes like this. As we move away from coal mining and steel production moves overseas, in West Virginia and parts of Pennsylvania, small towns are being left behind. That's a narrative, right? But for the past 20 years or so, entrepreneurs have been working on a different narrative in that part of the country. Julie Grant of the environmental reporting outlet Allegheny Front reports investments in recreation and tourism are starting to bear some real economic fruit.
About 10 years ago, after being downsized from a job in computer sales, Rod Darby wanted control of his career. He drew up a business plan for a pub and restaurant in West Newton, a small Pennsylvania town along the still-developing Great Allegheny Passage. The Gap Bike Trail, as it's known, stretches 150 miles from Pittsburgh to Cumberland, Maryland. Darby shopped his pub idea around.
I went to a large bank. They said, nope, that's not what we do. Went to a medium-sized bank. Hey, great plan. That's not what we do. Went to a small bank. Great plan. We're not sure about this trail.
Then he went to a nonprofit bank called the Progress Fund.
When he approached and said, I want to do something here, we were jumping for joy.
That's David Cayley, co-founder of the Progress Fund, which gets its money from private banks, foundations, and government sources. It's been investing in recreation and tourism in the region for 20 years. Cayley had been looking to encourage development along the Gap Trail when Rod Darby walked in the door. Today, Darby's Trailside Restaurant employs 16 people full-time, and Darby says business is hopping.
And people ask me all the time, does that trail help you out? And I said, the trail's the reason I'm here.
The Progress Fund's David Cayley walks a few feet to the trail.
We have all these nifty signs, so you don't get lost.
The Progress Fund has made 9 loans in West Newton, supporting pizza and fast food restaurants, a canoe and kayak outfitter, and the renovation of a bed and breakfast, totaling nearly $2.5 million.
That kind of level of investment is changing West Newton's future around tourism. Why 9 loans here? Well, that Great Allegheny Passage is a huge economic opportunity.
Outdoor recreation has been a growing economic engine nationwide. The Commerce Department recently reported that in 2016, the industry grew 3.8%. That was faster than the overall economic growth that year of 2.8%. And though it's still crunching the numbers, the Commerce Department estimates that represents about $374 billion of economic activity. Back on the trail, Cayley points out the new focus on recreation is a way to diversify the local economy that was once heavily dependent on coal and steel.
So it relies on the environmental qualities of the community rather than being the extractive industry.
The Progress Fund estimates the Gap Trail alone has created a benefit of $50 million annually along the route. Economists in nearby West Virginia don't expect low-wage recreation jobs like trail maintenance to replace well-paid coal jobs, but they see great potential for growth and point to one trail system in southern West Virginia for all-terrain vehicles. It's bringing in millions to the region for permits, lodging, food, and fuel. Kent Spellman sees outdoor recreation as a long-term strategy for the region's economic development. He's with the National Rails to Trails Conservancy and lives in West Virginia.
If we get just a small percentage of the people who come through our communities to be thinking down the road about maybe that would be a good place to rear a family, maybe that would be a good place to bring my small business, that is the goal of tourism. We should think of it as a recruitment tool, not as an end unto itself.
And back in West Newton, that's starting to happen. Young families have been moving in, and there's a new excitement as city leaders reinvent their old coal town as a trail town. In West Newton, I'm Julie Grant for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today, Oprah Winfrey and her co-stars in A Wrinkle in Time, the new Ava DuVernay movie that's coming out. They were doing a press thing the other day, and somehow they got on the topic of Starbucks. And Oprah says, this is from E! News, it's a quote, Oprah says, oh my God, I went 2 days ago. And the woman said, name? And I said, Oprah. And she said, how do you spell that? I don't buy that. All right, got to go. Dow Industrials off 380 points today, 1.5%. NASDAQ down 57, 0.7%. S&P 500 slipped 30 points, lower 1.1%. Sarah Bruguer, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostat, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.